It's The Takeaway for December 2nd. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're back with you after a long holiday weekend. UN member states mark the 31st annual World AIDS Day this Sunday, but even as science has made strides to lessen the impact of HIV, new advances in treatment and prevention are not being shared equitably.
You now have the government suing a major drug manufacturer for a drug that needs to be out there in the population more to try to halt the spread of HIV and AIDS.
We also look at the deep stigma that's still attached to HIV and AIDS, particularly in certain parts of the United States.
Being in a Bible Belt state, you got stigma surrounding the LGBTQ community. If you get tested, people think that you're doing something wrong.
Plus, it's Cyber Monday, and Amazon is hoping to ship more than 2 billion packages around the world. But the increase in orders means extra work for their employees.
It just seems as though Amazon has hijacked commerce, and we are all unwittingly helping them.
That's where we start today on the podcast. Let's go shopping, shall we? During last year's holiday season, Amazon shipped more than 2 billion packages around the world. And with the company's recent decision to expand free one-day shipping for Prime members, the online giant is hoping to ship even more. And with all those packages being sent out, you may be wondering how Amazon warehouses and their employees process that many orders. Well, here's how Amazon says they get it done.
Finally, Jackie gives every single box a long and loving hug before loading it onto a truck.
No, I don't.
Oh, maybe just this one?
Okay.
Aw, you love it.
The reality, though, is a little different. According to new reporting from The Atlantic and Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, 23 of Amazon's 110 national fulfillment centers had a rate of nearly 10 serious injuries per 100 full-time workers in 2018. The industry average, only 4 injuries. One of those workers is Vicky Shannon Allen.
They should know that that's our blood, sweat, and tears that's going into that.
Allen said she injured her back while processing packages and was left homeless after Amazon failed to pay out her workers' comp. Here she is on NBC News telling Amazon customers what they should know when ordering a package.
That's my back. That's somebody else's arm. That's somebody's life.
Allen is just one of countless Amazon workers who say they've been injured on the job. Joining me now are Brian Menegas, senior reporter for Gizmodo covering labor and technology, and Michael Sinato, freelance labor reporter for The Guardian. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for having me.
Michael, let's start with you. Why is the rate of serious injury so much higher at Amazon when you compare it to others in the same industry? What's going on there?
I think it really comes down to the production pressures put onto workers. You know, a lot of reporting has been done on that these workers have to hit a certain rate every hour, nonstop, and can face termination or discipline, will be constantly hounded by management if they don't hit that rate. And that's caused them to skip bathroom breaks, to continue pushing through injuries. And a lot of the work cases that I've covered, a lot of the workers I've spoken with, you know, that's a common issue, is people trying to work through repetitive motion injuries. They're working like robots, doing the same exact motion over and over and over and over.
So, Michael, when you say repetitive motion injuries, what do you mean? Like, is it sort of like a carpal tunnel syndrome? What kind of injuries result from that?
A lot of it gets diagnosed as carpal tunnel, but it can be anything related from hand and wrist injuries up to, like in Vicky's case, she hurt her back because something on her station, an ergonomic protection, was broken and Amazon didn't fix it. And she wound up, you know, throwing out her back and seriously injuring it because of it. And, you know, her back has still had problems and issues. And a lot of workers I've spoken with, you know, they've come across that same case. And when they go to Amazon's on-site medical care, AmCare, they're often, you know, sent back to work when they really shouldn't be, whether it's a repetitive motion injury. Or just to take an example, just a few weeks ago, I spoke to a warehouse worker in Etna, Ohio, outside of Columbus. He fell, hit his head, and he was bleeding from his head. AmCare bandaged his head, and he was sent back to work. He was bleeding through the bandages, and he had to have a friend bring him back to AmCare and force them to call an ambulance. He was later diagnosed with a concussion, and he's still waiting on, you know, workers' compensation benefits and dealing with medical bills and trying to work through the bureaucracy of, you know, whether Amazon and Amazon's workers' comp insurance will ultimately compensate him for those bills.
Ryan, I mean, what we're hearing, what Michael's saying, and what we heard at the top of the show is very different than what Amazon is advertising in terms of how it, you know, its workers are so happy to be hugging boxes and putting them on the out to the rest of us here. You reported on injury rates at a specific Amazon warehouse here in New York City on Staten Island. What did you find there?
So the facility in question is, in Amazon parlance, called JFK8. It's out on Staten Island, like you said, and it only opened in September-ish of last year. So the OSHA numbers in terms of injuries that Amazon is federally mandated to collect and report cover only about 3 months' worth of injuries, and in that time, they managed to rack up 107 incidents. So you're looking at an incident rate of 15.9, which against the national average of 3.1 for that year is pretty staggering.
And are they similar injuries to what Michael was describing, repetitive stress injuries, or are there other types of injuries you're seeing?
Sure. I mean, a lot of them are going to be sort of strains, sprains, bruises, that sort of thing. There were definitely some that would indicate something more like a repetitive motion injury that were written up as carpal tunnel. The way that they're documented doesn't provide a ton of detail as to the actual diagnosis. It's more just what's seen in the moment that allows them to take time away from work.
And Brian, what are the Amazon workers that you interviewed telling you about their experiences working there?
I've spoken to Amazon workers both at JFK and in the past at other facilities, and it is similar to what Michael's been talking about, which is that there is this sort of relentless rate of having to hit these numbers, having every bit of your workday tracked as metrics. And a lot of that results in, if workers have the option between missing their rate, missing their goals, which could result in them getting written up or terminated, or doing things in a way that's safer, then they will often pick the first option. And that results in people obviously getting hurt.
Michael, are there specific types of workers who are at greater risk for injury?
I think it comes across, you know, anyone. I've spoken with young people who are just college students trying to, you know, work at Amazon to make money while they're in school. And I've spoken with people, you know, in their 50s and 60s who have, you know, worked their whole lives and, you know, just wanted something new or enticed to work at Amazon because of how big of a company it is. So I don't think there's a specific type of person that is susceptible to these injuries. I think it can happen to any of these workers.
And Michael, when you, I'm sure you've asked Amazon about this, what has their response been to all of this reporting on their warehouse conditions? What are they saying?
Some of their responses have been, if our critics are so right, why do so many people work for Amazon? Which I think is kind of a ridiculous response. And a lot of it is, with these specific cases, sometimes they won't comment on them at all. You know, a lot of the cases there have been settlements that they can't comment on. A lot of workers are put into non-disclosure agreements, so they can't get into details or disclose the amount of money they received. So with a lot of these cases, there have been either cover-ups or attempt at cover-ups in terms of, you know, what actually happened, how Amazon responded or didn't respond to a certain incident.
I'd also say that Amazon tends to be pretty willing to spin information rather vigorously. And, you know, when I approached them about the numbers that they themselves reported on the Staten Island facility, what they told me was, quote, "It's inaccurate to say that Amazon fulfillment centers are unsafe, and efforts to paint our workplaces as such based solely on the number of injury recordings is misleading, given the size of our workforce," which is patently ridiculous on its face. I mean, the incident rate calculator that OSHA uses takes into account the size of the workforce. It calculates, you know, incidents that are reported against the number of hours that are worked total at a facility. So it shouldn't matter what the size of the workforce is.
And Brian, to that point, I mean, let's look outside of the workforce here, inside the warehouses. They're having an effect on the people in the communities that these warehouses are located in, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Sure. I mean, there's been different studies over the years. The most recent one that I can recall came from Economic Roundtable and looked at the counties around Los Angeles and found that in terms of things like road wear and emissions and noise complaints, just general use of public goods, that there was about $642 million worth of uncompensated wear. And that's not even including other studies that have looked into direct subsidies that state and local governments have given to Amazon to put facilities in their area. And I think the most recent figure from Good Jobs First has that at around $2.2 billion. And that's only what's known so far and been reported back through Freedom of Information Act requests.
One question for you each as we're running out of time in this segment. Michael, Amazon employees are publicly speaking out against these working conditions across the states. And in about a minute, can you tell us what their demands are, what they're looking for?
They're demanding safer practices, emphasis on safety, on workers should be given breaks. They should be taken care of when they're injured, given proper medical care, given proper workers' compensation benefits. See, they shouldn't have to hire an attorney, pay that them out of pocket, and have to fight for what comes from several months to, I've seen in some cases, several years to eventually win a settlement out of Amazon. These workers are hardworking people that are, at the end of the day, are just trying to get food on their table, just trying to make a living, and they shouldn't have to sacrifice their entire bodies and their livelihood, their quality of life to be able to do that.
Brian, minute left in the segment here. Mm-hmm. It's the holidays. Everybody's ordering on Amazon. What should consumers be aware of? Can they do anything differently?
I mean, I think there's a temptation to say that some of the blame lies on consumers, and it does. I mean, we have all become somewhat addicted to online shopping, but I would say take cues from the workers that are speaking out. This is something that rideshare drivers in New York have worked on with some effect. When they said, we're striking, please, if you're a customer and you need to get somewhere, find another way to do it just today. Don't worry about us the rest of the time. And I would say take your cues from workers. If they're walking out, if they're going on strike, do your best to support them.
Brian Menegis is senior reporter for Gizmodo covering labor and technology, and Michael Sinato is a freelance labor reporter for The Guardian. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sunday marked the 31st annual World AIDS Day, and while the medical community has made major strides towards reducing instances of the disease, we're still living in a world where 37.9 million people across the world are living with HIV or AIDS. In 2012, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new medicine, Truvada, for pre-exposure prophylaxis, also known as PrEP. And when taken regularly, the treatment reduces the chances of getting HIV in people that haven't yet been exposed to the virus. In the years since it came to market, it's been hailed as a game changer in the global fight against AIDS. But the cost of access means hundreds of thousands of people in the United States alone can't afford the treatment. And a recent CDC study found that this gap is especially pronounced among people of color. To help us understand why is Christopher Rowland, a healthcare and business reporter at The Washington Post. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So let's talk a little bit about who funded the research for Truvada, or behind Truvada for PrEP. How did this drug come to be?
So Truvada was an existing drug for the treatment of people who already have HIV, developed by Gilead Sciences, a San Francisco-based company that researched and developed the drug and got FDA approval for it in the early 2000s. As the drug was coming onto the market, the government, the Centers for Disease Control, began researching ways to for a preventative drug to prevent HIV from taking hold in a person who is sexually active. And so the government actually invented the use of this existing drug for prevention. And so that's really the key right now, is for people trying to halt the spread of HIV, is to get more people taking the drug of Truvada for prevention, Truvada for PrEP.
So just to be clear, does the U.S. government own the patent on the drug, but it's Gilead Sciences that makes the money, the $3 billion in sale of Truvada in 2018?
That's right. So Truvada holds the patent for the chemicals that are in the drug and the drug as it's used for treatment of AIDS and HIV. But the government has the patent for the prevention application of the drug. You know, the government researched that using CDC monkeys in Atlanta. They spent years testing it, making sure that it would work. It's remarkably effective, it turns out, at preventing HIV. So it's really an important drug. And so the government does hold those patents, and that has led to a dispute.
Tell us a little bit about that dispute, because, you know, we're talking really about cost here, aren't we?
So Gilead has refused to recognize the government's patents for Truvada for PrEP, and that has been a major bone of contention now for several years. The government didn't really do much to try to enforce its patent for the first several years. But then this year, it finally decided that it had had enough and filed a patent infringement lawsuit against Gilead. You know, advocates say the government needs to be more aggressive here because the government could extract royalties and other benefits that could be used to get Truvada spread more widely. You know, it needs to be out there in the population more to try to halt the spread of HIV and AIDS.
What does it cost to make a month's supply of Truvada for PrEP, and how much is it being sold for by Gilead?
Honestly, it costs pennies per pill to make a pharmaceutical. Once you have everything set up, you have all the research and development done, you have the approvals. Gilead and other distributors, they do distribute Truvada for PrEP in Africa and other countries for literally a few dollars a month. Here in the United States, the price is closer to approaching $2,000 a month, or around, you know, between $20,000 and $24,000 a year. And so that's where, you know, many advocates say Gilead is now gouging the consumers and gouging the government and insurers and charging too much for the drug. And that's why they really want the government to use its patent as leverage to try to drive that price down or to extract concessions from Gilead so that Truvada for PrEP could be more widely used.
We mentioned also at the top that there are really a small percentage of Americans who can actually access the drug because of that cost. I'm not sure if that's something that would be covered by insurance or not, but still a $2,000 a month cost is, I'm sure many Americans would agree, is outrageous. Who are the folks that are unable to access this drug?
Well, that's a complicated question because it gets into a lot of cultural issues as well as, you know, financial. It's not purely a financial equation. Certainly, people who have insurance and they live in urban areas where there's ready access to Truvada for PrEP are, you know, have the best access and they can get the drug and they can afford it. But, you know, a lot of people who are at risk of contracting HIV don't have insurance. So, you know, state Medicaid programs do pay for it, but again, people might not be plugged into Medicaid. They might be living in ways that make them hard to, you know, get connected with healthcare. And also culturally, there's, especially in the South, and you mentioned in the intro and among African Americans, there's a lot of stigma for being gay. A lot of people are still in the closet. That's not even safe for them to be out in some of these communities. And so going to the CVS and getting Truvada for PrEP is not really an option for them. So it's been hard to get Truvada to all the people who need it.
Are there any efforts by, you mentioned Medicaid covers this, but are there any other efforts by the U.S. government to try and make Truvada more widely available, accessible, or even, you know, penetrating communities that, or really getting access to communities that that may be resistant?
Yes, for sure. So the CDC and the and the Trump administration has made a very ambitious goal of trying to eradicate HIV within the next decade or so. And as part of that, they have struck a deal with Gilead that's separate from their whole patent dispute to donate free Truvada for PrEP so that the government can then figure out how to distribute it for free. Still, it's not, you know, going to be enough drugs to meet the government's goals, but it will be a start.
Christopher Rowland is a business reporter for The Washington Post. Christopher, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
According to the CDC, in 2017, southern states made up a disproportionate number of new HIV diagnoses compared to other sections of the country. And beyond hurdles to access HIV treatment, there are stigmas and misconceptions surrounding the disease that create an additional challenge for many people living with HIV and AIDS. Here with us now is Cedric Sturdivant, an outreach coordinator at the AIDS Services Coalition. Cedric, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So you were diagnosed with HIV, and I'm curious, what were the reactions to your diagnoses from people around you at the time?
Well, I was diagnosed in March of 2005. At the time of my diagnosis, there was only one other person that knew, and that was my partner. So at this point, I was kind of afraid to tell family or anyone else because I didn't know much about HIV or AIDS other than the stigma that surrounded it and how people living with HIV or AIDS was getting treated. And I didn't want to get that treatment because I was really afraid to tell my family or anybody else.
Let's talk a little bit about that stigma. I grew up in an era when I remember the first AIDS cases were being reported in the late 1980s with these stereotypes at the time that were just very pervasive. But we're now in 2019. What are the stigmas today, Cedric?
Well, I'm going to talk about Mississippi, where I'm at. The biggest stigma is the fact that people are, even though it's been such a long time, they're still kind of uneducated about the disease. There's this strange that when we go out and do presentations, especially with young people, we still hear that, you know, you can get it from mosquitoes. And being in a Bible Belt state, you got stigma surrounding the LGBTQ community. So that kind of carries over into a person living with HIV or people being afraid to get tested simply because people will think that if you get tested, people think that you're doing something wrong. That's why you're getting tested. You still get shamed in a sense, or you may feel like you're getting shamed. If you like going to a clinic and there's a clinic where people know that's where people living with HIV go, and you may not even be going for that. So all of that actually kind of plays a part. And the bottom line is that we need more education around the disease, especially in the area that I'm in, which is called the Mississippi Delta, which is basically one of the poorest areas in our state.
I was going to ask you about education because, again, at the beginning of the crisis back in the late 1980s, one of the things that was so prevalent was education and trying to educate the community on how to protect yourself and, you know, really breaking down these stigmas that you can't get it from this or from that or from whatever. And, if you hug somebody who is HIV positive, that's not going to pass that on to you. What is the state of HIV and AIDS education today, Cedric?
I want to say it's kind of like very much needed because we've gotten away from it in a sense to the fact that most people thinking that HIV is not an issue anymore. We've come up with all the new biomedical interventions and what have you, but we're not reaching the community as far as education on that to let them know that there are, you know, a lot of medication or whatever to prevent from contracting HIV and also for those that's living with HIV to live a healthy life. So that information is not getting out, especially here in our state, not as it should. It mostly get out in the metropolitan area, but the rural areas of our state is not getting out. So people really don't know that information. They may see a commercial on TV and that's it, but they're not getting the full education about that.
At the same time, you mentioned your work is mostly focused on the Mississippi Delta area. HIV rates are rising quickly in that area. What has been the most challenging part of your work so far?
The most challenging part is actually getting people to come out and get tested. We have at the office here in the area I'm at, we do free testing. People are kind of like, Just afraid. And especially if we're looking at and not targeting the black gay men, but if we look at black gay men, there's nowhere for them actually to frequent here. There's no clubs or bars in this area. A lot of them are still kind of afraid to be themselves in this area. And it's so widespread. Before we came here a year and a half ago, there was really no community-based organization that was doing prevention work or the education work in the area. Is mostly just clinics.
Let's talk a little bit about prevention. Condoms used to be the gold standard, if you will, in talking about prevention. And now, today, we have PrEP and Truvada on the market for those who are not infected with HIV or AIDS. What is the range of preventative measures that you're seeing? Are people still talking about condoms? Are people aware of PrEP or Truvada?
People are still talking about condoms for sure. But as far as PrEP and PEP, there's not a big awareness in the rural areas. As I mentioned, when we go out and do preventions, we went to a college, a community college, a couple of months ago. And when we asked the students there, do they know about PrEP, or do they know what PrEP is? And to be honest, probably out of a class of 20-something, we probably had about 5 people that raised their hand. And that information that they got about PrEP was through a commercial on television. So, like I said, the education for these preventive methods are not getting to the community, especially in the rural areas, like they should. Of course, we do talk condom. Even if we talk PrEP, we talk condoms. And we pass out condoms, and we have a safety delivery package where they can order the condoms themselves. But still, in these areas, we have to educate them on the proper way to use condoms as well. And a lot of times, especially young men, they just want the name brand condoms like Trojans or Magnums or what have you. And we have to explain to them that the lifestyle condoms are just as good as those condoms.
Cedric, there was a recent study conducted by Merck, which is a company that manufactures drugs for HIV treatment. And they found that almost 1/3 of millennials have a deep stigma against people with HIV, including not even wanting to hug them. Are you surprised at that finding?
I'm not, especially in rural areas, simply because it goes back to education. It's not being done like it was done, I would say, 13 years ago when I first entered into the field of doing this work. So I'm not surprised by that. When I go on some of the websites, I will see people say, in a sense, I don't want to talk to nobody that's HIV positive. So, no, I'm not surprised by that. That probably is very accurate.
Cedric Sturdivant is an outreach coordinator at the AIDS Services Coalition. Thank you so much, Cedric.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper, with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.